This one's titled The Price to be Paid. Hebrews 10 verse 38, now the just shall live by faith. But if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. That's rather sad. That some people can actually embrace the faith, and then because it gets a bit tough and the weeds grow and choke you out, that you give it up. If any man shrink back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. We need to stand, because the reward is great. We needn't give up. Here I am in London, and this is the great St. Paul's Cathedral. And I'd been in St. Paul's Cathedral before, and it's in one of my previous lectures. There are incredible signs and wonders in that cathedral. And so I took all of those pictures, and they are in a previous lecture. Also Masonic symbols all over the place. Fascinating place. But when I was there this time, they were renovating it. And there was a long lineup or queue to get into this building. And I was wondering, what's going on? Why is there such a long lineup? I finally got somewhere close to the point, and I saw you had to pay to go inside. Something like £10. That's a lot of money for a Southern African. That's 140 rand. That's the equivalent in spending capacity of $140. To someone living there and earning them in that currency. Well, that was a lot of money. So I inquired, you know, why is it so expensive to go into this place? No. They're renovating the place and they need the funds. So it reminded me of St. Peter's Cathedral, where they sold indulgences to renovate the place. Remember that? And so when I got to the front of the queue, I said to the man, I would go in and pay the £10, but seeing that it is for the renovation of the cathedral, I would please want the indulgence to go with it. And he wasn't amused, and I said to him, but your mother... They offered an indulgence, and you're back there right now. You're all under one roof. Why can't I have an indulgence? And I'm always naughty. Anyway, he didn't give me an indulgence. I was most upset. Isn't it magnificent, this building? Totally refurbished, looking exactly like St. Peter's. And if you're going to pay for the renovation of St. Peter's, you might as well get an indulgence. I mean, please. It is a replica. It is an image of the beast. Fascinating. Protestantism has gone all the way. In 1887, Grattan Guinness wrote, 50 years ago, the eminent statesman Sir Robert Peel said with remarkable clear foresight. Now please consider, this is 120 years ago. The day is not distant and may be very near when we shall all have to fight the battle of the Reformation over again. I wonder what this person would write today. The day is far gone for people to stand up and fight the battle of the Reformation all over again. Then he writes, the day has come. So I guess in our time we have to say the day is gone. We're almost too late. More than 3 centuries of emancipation, what will he say after 4? From the yoke of Rome, 300 years of Bible light and liberty had made us overconfident and led us to underestimate the power and influence of the deadliest foe, not only of the gospel of God, but also of Protestant England. Britain's honorable distinction of being the leading witness amongst the nations for the truth of the gospel and against the errors of Romanism had come to be lightly esteemed amongst us. 120 years ago. Our fathers won this distinction through years of sore struggle and strife. They purchased it with their best blood and prized it as men prize that which cost them dear. It had cost us nothing. We were born to it. We knew not its value by contrast as they did. In the early part of this century, the power of Rome was in these lands a thing of the past. And it seemed to be fast decaying even in other lands. The notion grew up amongst us that there was no need to fear any revival of that deadly upas tree, which is the blight of all that is great and good and pure and prosperous. The light of the true knowledge had forever dispelled the dark fogs of superstition, so it was supposed. Medieval tyrannies and cruelties cloaked under a pretense of religion could never again obtain a footing in these lands of light and liberty. We might despise and deride the corruptions and follies of Rome, but as to dreading her influence, no. She was too far gone and too feeble to inspire fear or even watchfulness. Our Reformed faith is thus endangered both from without and from within, and it can only be defended by a resolute return to the true witness borne by saints and martyrs of others' days. We must learn afresh from divine prophecy, God's estimate of the character of the Church of Rome, if we would be moved afresh to be witnesses for Christ as against this great apostasy. Interesting, huh? 120 years ago. I wonder what he would say today. Well, he's resting. 2 Peter 20, verse 20. For if after they have escaped the pollution of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled therein and overcome, the latter end is worse with them than the beginning. If you were in darkness, that was one thing. But if you embrace the light and then you turn your back on the light, the latter end is worse than the beginning. Verse 21 says, for it had been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than after they have known it to turn from the holy commandment delivered unto them. But it happened to them, according to the true proverb, the dog is turned to his own vomit again, and the sow that was washed to her wallowing in the mire. Bible is so cute, you know. Just takes it right there and says, this is what it is. If you've had light and you reject it, you're worse off than you were when you didn't have the light. In fact, the Bible says, seven demons worse than the first come back. And it's a nightmare. There's nothing worse than a really apostate Christian. Really, nothing worse. I want to take you through a little bit of history. This is the Martyrs' Memorial. And if I say the name Thomas Cranmer, how many people will raise their hands and say, I know that guy, I know exactly what he did? Anybody willing to? There is one or two, maybe. What about Nicholas Ridley? What that man did? What about Hugh Latimer? Do people walk around talking about Hugh Latimer? Man, you know, remember Hugh Latimer? Nah. Superman, they'll remember. Batman, maybe Davy Crockett. But Cranmer, Ridley, Latimer? Nah. They're forgotten. And that is why I decided I'm going to take this worldwide. These people may not be forgotten. We have to be reminded of what they did, what they stood for, because are we going to have to do it again, maybe? Well, here's the Martyrs' Memorial, Thomas Cranmer, and you can see these were not young gentlemen. They are depicted here as grey, and in Oxford the students walk by and they see the spire and it's not so pretty anymore, the birds sit on it, nobody really cares, nobody knows what really happened there. And yet these were bishops of the Anglican Church. And Cranmer was the Archbishop of Canterbury. He was the head of the Anglican Church. His present day equivalent would be Rowan Williams. So these were prominent people, and they were Protestants. Now, Ridley supported Lady Jane Grey's claim to the crown. And in 1553, shortly after the accession of the Catholic Mary the First, he was imprisoned with Cranmer and Hugh Latimer. He took part in 1554 in the Oxford disputations against a group of Catholic theologians and would not recant his Protestant faith. You see, England had become Protestant. It was an amazing feat. Absolutely phenomenal change. The whole of England had converted to Protestantism. And after Henry VIII died, Lady Jane Grey was enthroned. And she just managed to hang in there for a couple of days. And she was beheaded. Lady Jane Grey's execution. And Mary the First ascended the throne. She had another rival, Elizabeth the First. She threw her in a dungeon, took away her clothes, and the only thing she had was a Bible. Don't underestimate great Elizabeth the First. The stories that we hear and that we see in the media and in the movies about Elizabeth the First. There's another story to that tale which is very much untold these days. But I'm not going to talk about Elizabeth the First. I'm going to talk about Mary the First. She was known as Bloody Mary and it had nothing to do with vodka. But the color of the drink had something to do with it. Because the Bloody Mary is what? Vodka and tomato juice. Because that's the color of blood. And she caused more blood to flow than anyone would care to remember. Queen Mary the First, known as Bloody Mary. She had this friendly disposition on her face, as you can see. And she had all Protestants of high position arrested, tried, many of them executed publicly. She burnt over 300 people publicly, and thousands rotted in dungeons and died from hunger, starvation. She is not for nothing known as Bloody Mary. We read in the book The Great Controversy about Hugh Latimer. He was an interesting man, an old bishop. "Do you know," said Latimer, "who is the most diligent bishop in England? I see you listening and harking that I should name him. I will tell you, it is the devil." He's cute, then. "He's never out of his diocese. You will never find him idle. Call him when you will. He is ever at home. He is ever at the plough. You shall never find him remiss, I warrant you, where the devil is resident. There, away with books, and up with candles. Away with Bibles, and up with beads. Away with the light of the gospel and up with the light of wax tapers. Yea, at noonday, down with Christ's cross. Up with the purgatory pick purse." You know, put the money in for indulgences. "Away with clothing the naked, the poor, the impotent. Up with the decking of images and gay garnishing of stones and stocks. Down with God and His most holy word. Up with traditions, human counsels, and a blinded pope. Oh, that our prelates would be as diligent to sow the corn of good doctrine as Satan is to sow the cockle and darnel. This is what these old bishops were like. They said it like it was. They were tough. They weren't scared to speak. But he paid for it. He paid for it with his life. And then on October 16, 1555, Bishop Ridley and Bishop Latimer were led to their martyrdom. Now this story is fascinating. Ridley came fully robed as he would be dressed as a bishop. Latimer wore a simple frieze frock. The 70-year-old Latimer followed feebly behind Ridley. Ridley gave his clothes away to those standing by. Latimer quietly stripped to his shroud. And though in his clothes he had appeared a withered, crooked old man, he now stood bolt upright. And they were fastened to their stakes. Ridley's brother tied a bag of gunpowder to both of their necks. And then as a burning faggot was lit at the feet of Ridley, Latimer cheered him with the words that will live in the memory of English Protestants, "So long as history shall run." When I read that, I thought, oh, here we have a problem. People don't even know who Ridley was, let alone Latimer or any one of those. Well, if this is going to be remembered as long as history shall run, then somebody better do something about it. Now, what did he say? Here they are being tied to the stake, and the people all around watching. And he said, "Be of good comfort, Master Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out." It's pretty tough, eh? You're going to your death. And they tied this gunpowder around them, and they lighted those faggots, and the wind came from the one side, and Latimer was quickly dead. And Ridley stood, the wind from the wrong side, the faggots packed up high, choking out, no air, no oxygen coming through. And he smoldered, and he was charcoal up to his waist, and still alive. Can you imagine that? Then somebody realized what was going on eventually, and ripped some of the faggots away, and the air came in, and the fire took hold, and the gunpowder exploded, and Ridley died. A horrendous death. "Be of good cheer, Master Ridley, and play the man. And we shall by God's grace light such a candle in England as shall never go out." And Cranmer, he had been elected Archbishop of Canterbury by the Pope, because England used to be Catholic. But then he converted to Protestantism. He couldn't be put to death because they had to wait for a note from the Pope to say that Cranmer could be sentenced to death as well. So they took Cranmer and they put him on top of the wall and they said, "Watch your favorite bishops die." And he watched as Ridley suffered horrendously and he fainted. He fainted. He couldn't handle it. And eventually, when it was all over, they took him and they put him in the dungeon. And they worked on him, and they worked on him, and they worked on him. And finally, the old man cracked. And he signed the recantation. Interesting history. Cranmer was not allowed to seal his fate with his life for another 6 months. For the Pope's assent was sought to the burning of the prelate who had been consecrated while England still recognized the papal supremacy. The old man was induced more than once to give his enemies the opportunity of saying that he, once the leader amongst the Protestants of England, had recanted. Here's the good news. At last he saw his error, and his old steadfastness was restored to him. Revoking his recantation, he added, "Forasmuch as my hand offended, writing contrary to my heart, my hand shall be first punished, therefore, For may I come to the fire, it shall first be burned. And when he came to the stake on March 21st, 1556, on the same spot where his friends Ridley and Latimer had suffered, he resolutely thrust his hand into the flames as they drew near him and was heard to say repeatedly, "That unworthy right hand." History tells us he stuck his hand out and put them in the fire. And they burnt while he was alive until both his fingers dropped off. And he didn't move. He put them in the fire. And he said, "That unworthy hand, that unworthy right hand." Amazing stories. And nobody knows about Cranmer. And nobody knows about Latimer. And nobody knows about Ridley. And here is the spot where they were burnt today. There are big buildings there in Oxford. And here on this building, there's a little plaque, which nobody can even see what's on it, telling us where the spot was. And the students walked by, and the students walked by. And so I went and enlarged it just a little bit, and it said, opposite this point, near the cross in the middle of Broad Street, Hugh Latimer, one-time Bishop of Worcester, Nicholas Ridley, Bishop of London, and Thomas Cranmer, Archbishop of Canterbury, were burned for their faith. In 1555, the two of them, and in 1556, Cranmer. Oh, I walked to the middle of the road, and there's the spot where he was burned, or they were burned. And the students walk by, and the students walk over the spot, and the bicycles ride by, and the bicycles drive over the spot. And nobody knows what happened there. They haven't got a clue. They haven't got a clue. Cranmer's story needs more elaboration. 1539. Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, hired Miles Coverdale. This is when he was still in control and the Protestant bishop, at the bequest of King Henry VIII, to publish the Great Bible. It became the first English Bible authorized for public use, as it was distributed to every church, chained to the pulpit, and a reader was even provided so that the illiterate could hear the Word of God in plain English. So this archbishop said, put the Bible in every church and let everybody read it. And if you can't read it, I'll supply someone to read it for you. Isn't that fantastic? That's what Ezra the scribe did when they rediscovered the word. He had it read to the people. And Cranmer did exactly the same thing. It would seem that William Tyndale's last wish had been granted. And William Tyndale, how did he write that Bible? As a fugitive. God's rebel. God's fugitive. Always on the run. Always changing his address. Writing the Bible. Brilliant scholar. You think Shakespeare was responsible for the magnificence of the English language? Forget it. He got it from Tyndale and the Bible. And here they were. And Tyndale was strangled and then burned. Just 3 years after his martyrdom, Cranmer's Bible, published by Coverdale, was known as the Great Bible due to its great size, a large pulpit folio measuring over 14 inches tall. 7 editions of this version were published between April 1539 and December 1541. Well, let's go to this little place over here in Oxford. This is the Church of St. Mary's. And this is where they dragged Cranmer when he recanted. Now, he used to be a Catholic, had become a Protestant, and now he was just nobody. And he had recanted. But they weren't going to put him on the pulpit. No, that's too high and exalted. But they wanted him to tell the people that he had recanted. So what to do? Can't put him on the pulpit. Then he's too high. Can't have him standing on the floor. Nobody can see who's speaking. Everything is on one level. So what they do, they chopped a little piece out of the pillar, put a chair or something there, and a plank over it, leaning on the pillar, and there he stood. And he had to make his little speech of recantation. Let me take you into that cathedral. There it is. Today it is, of course, again a Protestant. Let me correct that. And it's supposedly Protestant cathedral. And this is what it looks like today. There's some interesting plaques over here on the wall. And some of the history is written over here. And it says there on one of the plaques, the Archbishop Cranmer and Bishop Ridley and Latimer were twice tried for heresy in St. Mary's Church during Catholic Queen Mary's attempt to reverse the Reformation. Ridley and Latimer were burned at the stake, 1555. Cranmer recanted. In 1556, he was again brought to St. Mary's. This pillar, this is the plaque on the pillar, had been cut away to allow the building of a low platform from which he was to make his submissions. At the last moment, the man stood there on this plank. He saw his former congregation, and something happened in him. At the last moment, he withdrew his recantation. He walked from the church to the fire with a firm step and a smiling countenance, putting first into the flame the hand which had signed the recantation. And there is the piece of the pillar that they chopped out. And there they put this plank. And they said, "You stand on them and tell them that you have recanted from your Protestant faith." And he made a speech. Fantastic speech. Let's read it. These are the words he wrote. "For as much as I am to the last end of my life, whereupon all hangeth of my life past and my life to come, either to live with my Master Christ forever in joy, or else to be in pain forever with wicked devils in hell, and I see before mine eyes presently either heaven ready to receive me, or hell ready to swallow me up, I shall therefore declare unto you my very faith, how I believe, without any color or dissimulation. For now is no time to dissemble whatsoever I had said or written in times past." Well, they'd actually assured him that the Queen would forgive him if he just made this recantation. She'd actually said, "Her Majesty will have Cranmer a Catholic, or she will have no Cranmer at all." Interesting. Well, we don't have to read everything he says. We'll read it in a moment. Between 9 and 10 o'clock, March 21, 1556, he was led forth to be burned in the place where his friends had suffered. While he was hurried to the stake, he declared, on his way, "And as for the Pope, I refuse him as Christ's enemy and Antichrist with all his false doctrines." His sufferings were short, as the fire soon blazed fiercely. Continuing his speech. Having briefly expressed the chief articles of his faith, he referred to his previous recantation, and he said, "And now I come to the great thing that so much troubleth my conscience, more than anything I ever did or said in my whole life, and that is the setting abroad of a writing contrary to the truth, which now here I renounce and refuse as things written with my hand, contrary to the truth which I thought in my heart, and which was written for fear of death and to save my life if it might be. And that is all such bills and papers which I have written or signed with my hand since my degradation, when I have written many things untrue, and for as much as my hand offended, writing contrary to my heart. My hand shall first be punished therefore, for may I come to the fire, it shall be burnt. And as for the Pope, I refuse him as Christ's enemy and Antichrist with all his false doctrines." So these were the great Oxford martyrs, these three. On uttering this, Cranmer was pulled down from the stage and led to the fire. Having put off his outer garments, he stood there in a shirt hung down to his feet. His beard was long and thick and covered his bosom. And then with an iron chain tied about him, the fire set to the faggots. When these were kindled and the fire began to burn near him, stretching out his arm, he put his right hand into the flame, holding it there immovable. Thus did he stand, moving no more than the stake to which he was bound. His eyes were lifted to heaven, and often he repeated this, "Right hand has offended, O this unworthy right hand." At last, in the greatness of the flame, he cried, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit," and gave up the ghost. These people were tough. They stood for something. Well, let's go back to this church. This is the church where Protestantism actually flourished and took hold. And here's another little plaque on that pillar. And this is a plaque to John Henry Newman. Now let's jump 300 years, almost 300 years into the future. So less than 300 years. 1833. John Keble preached from the pulpit in the Size Sermon, which is said to have initiated the Oxford movement. Under his influence and that of Edward Pusey and John Newman, vicars of St. Mary, from 1828, the church became the center of the Tractarians' attempt to revive spiritual life of the church and the university. Now, let's see what this revival was about. With more frequent celebrations of the Eucharist and a generally more Catholic theology. So it took less than 300 years to turn the Reformation upside down. Newman drew huge congregations to hear him preach, as Matthew Arnold wrote, "Who could resist the charm of that spiritual apparition? Gliding in the dim afternoon light through the aisles of St. Mary's, rising into the pulpit, and then in the most entrancing of voices, breaking the silence with words and thoughts which were a religious movement, subtle, sweet, and mournful." And he turned that whole stage upside down. And Britain lost its Protestantism. Well, here is the church. Here is the altar. The altar is back. They wrote then, "If you see an altar, run. We don't need an altar. We had an altar. Christ has been sacrificed. No need for an altar in a church." And here above the altar, the saints and Mary and candles and the whole catastrophe. Everything is back. There she is in the middle. And all the pictures and all the venerations back. And here's a little commemorative plaque. So I went through that cathedral with a magnifying glass. Found this little plaque. Photographed it. There it is. It's illegible, so I wrote it for you. The figures of the saints above the high altar were restored by the Anglo-Catholic Congress to commemorate the centenary of the Oxford movement. And to keep in honored memory its leaders, especially John Keble, professor of poetry, John Henry Newman, fellow of Oriel College and sometime vicar of this church, Richard Harold Froude, fellow of the Oriel College, Edward Bouveret Pusey, Regris professor of Hebrew. Let us now praise famous men and our fathers who begat us. Good grief. 14 July 1833 to 14 July 1933. And then, Newman, once he had established this tremendous Catholic revival, walked out of the Anglican Church and joined the Catholic Church. Oh, the Te Deum bells rang and the Pope rejoiced. And the music in the Vatican was unheard of. And the Pope welcomed him into the arms of the Catholic Church and made him a cardinal. And he became Cardinal Newman. And upon his death, he was, of course, immediately sainted. No, he wasn't. But they're doing it now. Oh yes, they are commemorating the victory over Protestantism. And Cardinal Newman will be a saint, and you can pray to him and get some absolution from his extreme dignity. How far will these people go? Let's have a look at it. CNA, Catholic News Agency. Cardinal Newman, beatification hoped for this year as saint guidelines tighten. Vatican City, January 11, 2008. Cardinal Henry, John Henry Newman, the famous 19th century British convert to Catholicism, could be beatified this year even as Pope Benedict tightens the guidelines for canonization. The Daily Telegraph reports, on Tuesday, CNA reported that Cardinal Joe Sarah Martin told the Vatican newspaper La Osservatore Romano that Cardinal Newman's beatification was imminent. Now he has given an even more specific time frame, telling the Daily Telegraph that he hoped the beatification would happen this year. Oh, excitement. Cardinal Newman, a prominent cleric in the Anglican Church, caused great controversy when he converted to Catholicism in 1845. His defense of Catholic beliefs was remarkable for Victorian England, and his explanations of the development of Christian doctrine continue to be very influential. He died in 1890. And now what they're doing with him? I don't believe this. Catholic Online. Cardinal Newman's bones to be removed for veneration. When was this? The 8th month, the 15th day, 2008. That's just the other week. The Catholic Herald, these will be most likely be bones from his hands, which will be shared out between key churches in Britain. Exciting. As well as one being sent to the Vatican. London, the Catholic Herald, bones are to be removed from the body of Cardinal John Henry Newman so that they can be venerated as holy relics. The government has granted a license permitting undertaking to dig up the body of Cardinal Newman more than a century after his death. What is Rome celebrating by doing this right now? They are celebrating the destruction of Protestantism. And my prayer is that the prayers of those dying people will not be forgotten as they stood in those flames, but that there will be a new resistance such as the world has never seen. And that the beast and his dragon lord may be so stunned and surprised that he won't even know what hit him. Officials from the Ministry of Justice have also given the go-ahead for Catholic experts in holy objects to fly in from Italy to retrieve major relics from the corpse after the coffin is opened for the first time. They should send holograms. Just think of all that carbon emission they're going to produce to get hold of a little finger or something from the hand of Cardinal Newman. Isn't this pathetic? In this day and age, this is blatant rubbing the nose of Protestantism in the quagmire of lies. Well, I want to take you to Smithfield. This is where Queen Mary managed to burn over 300 martyrs. And you go to Smithfield and you see, oh, here's a big station. There's nothing. You really have to look. You walk past this building, here's a little plaque. Tiny little plaque. West Smithfield, EC1. Smithfield Station. There it is. This is what you see. There's no memorial. There's nothing. Absolutely nothing. Just a little plaque against the wall. And you can't even read it. It's behind the bar. There you can see it. And there's a tiny little plaque which I took a separate picture of and enlarged it so that you don't need a magnifying glass to read it. And it said, it erected 1870 by the Protestant Alliance London. And it's got a couple of names here. Within this, whatever, John Rogers, John Bradford, he's got a couple of names there, and that's it. Nobody has the foggiest idea what's going on here. What happened to these people? They died here. They were burnt for their faith. Who is this John Rogers?
Thank you.